On this week's 51%, it's living large with a same-sex couple from many decades ago.
They were people who just enjoyed themselves. I think that's how they managed to live so long, considering how much they smoked and drank and ate all the wrong things.
And women going to or teaching at the gym is commonplace in the U.S., but not in another country. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Living Large, Wilna Hervey and Nan Mason, by noted silent film historian Joseph Eckhart, is a dual biography and a love story. Wilna Hervey, a 6 foot 3 inch, 300-pound heiress, won the role of the powerful Katrinka in the Toonerville trolley comedies of the early 1920s because of her impressive size. While filming on location in the Philadelphia suburbs, Wilna Hervey met Nan Mason, the surprisingly tall daughter of her Toonerville co-star Dan Mason. Wilna and Nan became inseparable friends and ultimately life partners for 59 years. When Wilna's cinema work began to wane, she and Nan decided to pursue careers as artists in the famed Artist Colony at Woodstock, New York. As artists, the two evolved into accomplished talents, exploring a wide variety of genres over the course of their long careers. As a same-sex couple, living in one of the few American communities at the time where they could comfortably be themselves, the Big Girls, as they were known locally, carved out extraordinary, creative lives. They hosted some of the wildest parties ever seen in the Catskills and used their legendary full moon soirees to raise money for such local causes as the Woodstock Library and the Children's Health Center. The two were never apart from the fall of 1923 until Wilna's death in the spring of 1979. Joseph Eckhart, again the author of Living Large, Wilna Hervey and Nan Mason, says the book was born of his interest in the silent Toonerville trolley comedies made at the Bettswood Studio in the Philadelphia suburbs. I asked how he stumbled across these women.
Well, stumble across them is pretty much the operative word. About 25, 30 years ago, I was doing some research on some silent films that had been made in the Philadelphia suburbs, and Wilna Hervey was one of the stars of those films. These were the Toonerville trolley movies. And she was fascinating. You know, the first time I saw her, I was absolutely captivated by this enormous woman. But she was so young, and she had this oblivious, innocent look on her face, and the combination was just fascinating and charming. So I always wondered, who was she? Where did they find an actress like this? And I also wondered, where did she go? Because as I looked into it, she seems to come and disappear from the movie industry very quickly. So about 7-8 years ago, I decided I want to find out once and for all the story of Wilna Hervey. And as I looked into it, one day I found her in the census with the name Nan Mason right underneath of it. And I thought, oh, this story just got a lot more interesting. And bit by bit, the story grew to the point where I couldn't resist doing something more with it than just satisfying my curiosity.
What did you uncover? I shouldn't say uncover, it's there, but what did you find?
Well, what I found is that Wilna did leave the movie industry fairly early, in the early 1920s, and she and Nan Mason, who was the daughter of her co-star in the movies, formed a very close companionship. They, in fact, became life companions, and they went off to the Woodstock Art Colony in New York to become artists, which they did, and they did that rather successfully. So the story arc was completely unexpected. I've often said that Wilna's life story has more twists and turns than some of the comedies that she made, because it seems like every couple of years there's something different that you don't expect in her ongoing life.
Did you visit the Woodstock area?
When I write, I have to get to the people, in some way. And I was lucky enough to get in their houses. They're all private residences now, but the owners were very, very, very gracious and cordial, let me in. And visited their graves and wandered around all the places that were familiar to them. And also, there are archival materials in Woodstock that I was able to access. And that made up a good bulk of the story.
Did the homeowners know who was living there at one time? Were they aware?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
In fact, the man who owns Treasure Farm still, Bill Hitzig, knew the Big Girls when he was a little kid. His parents were very close friends of theirs, and he and his siblings all remember them very well. I interviewed almost everybody in that family. The man who had just purchased the little cottage where Wilna and Nan lived most of their lives had just found out about them shortly before I contacted him. So he was really excited that I was, you know, I suddenly appeared and I was answering the questions that he and his wife were formulating. So they were all very, very pleased to talk to me and very, you know, very interested in what I had to say about their properties too.
Paint a picture of this life in Woodstock at during that time with, you know, these big girls, as they were known, and a same-sex couple to boot.
Well, they weren't the first or the last same-sex couple in Woodstock, and that was to their advantage, of course. In the 1920s, obviously, there were only a very few places in the United States where a couple like that could live openly without any worries of any sort. And Woodstock was a very laid-back community. One of the founders of Woodstock had created a motto that the town more or less still runs by, do what you want to do as long as you don't harm anyone. And that was pretty much, you know, the mood and the atmosphere in Woodstock. So they hadn't chosen Woodstock for that reason, but they sort of lucked out and found the perfect place for them to live for, you know, 50-plus years.
Could you take us on a bit of a journey with the twists and turns? Because in watching that video online, it was fascinating, and maybe you could kind of condense that.
Well, for one thing, both women started out fairly wealthy. In the 1920s, Wilna inherited a sizable fortune from her mother and then from her father, who died a few years later. So Wilna had the equivalent of several million dollars in today's currency. And Nan's father, who was a very successful character actor in Hollywood, died in 1929, and he left her his whole estate. I don't know the amounts in that case, but it was substantial. So on the verge of the Great Depression, these two girls had enormous amounts of money, but then came the Depression and it wiped them out. So they went from being independently wealthy to really scrambling to make ends meet. And one of the things I found remarkable about them is that it didn't change their personalities or their lifestyle at all. They did, like, just kept on doing exactly what they always did, which was what they wanted to do. So that was one of the major twists and turns. And then in their later years, a very wealthy friend of theirs left them a substantial amount of money to take care of them in their old age. And so they go from having lots of money to having no money to having somebody, you know, leave them a great windfall again in their late years. So they were very fortunate in that regard. There were also a lot of twists and turns artistically. They were both very resourceful artists and very curious. And if they found out about something like, say, silk screening or photography or enameling, they jumped on it. Oh, that's interesting. I want to do that too. And so their art goes in all directions, and they really, the only art form they didn't explore was sculpture, but pretty much everything else in terms of graphic art they took up, and they usually mastered the task.
What was interesting was in your research in Woodstock, I don't know if this is where it happened, but fortunately for you, becoming a dual biographer, right, they were pack rats.
Oh, my God, they were pack rats. Yes. They saved everything. The man who had the unenviable task of cleaning out their house when they died has become a good friend of mine. And when he starts to tell the story of, you know, he rolls his eyes and his wife rolls their eyes because they encountered the most awful mess. It was all packed into the attic of the garage or the barn where they had lived and packed into a garage that was leaking. And to their enormous credit, they didn't throw away anything that they could save. They realized the significance of it. And so there were hundreds of letters, you know, amounting to thousands of pages, and hundreds of photographs, and dozens of works of art that were available to me for research. It was really more than was necessary, which is a wonderful happenstance for a researcher.
Absolutely. And also audio.
Yes. One of Wilma's birthday parties had been recorded, and this was just turned up in a box of junk, actually. And when I took it home and had it digitized, here was Wilna and Nan on tape and their friends, and they were all drunk and rowdy and screaming and shrieking and singing. And it was just a wonderful evocation of, you know, their lifestyle.
And to hear comments made, right? And to just get the feeling of being in the room, so to speak.
Oh, yes. And I've been in that room where that, you know, where that recording was made. And that was sort of ringing in the back of my mind as I was touring that house.
What was your sense of how the Woodstock community, how well they knew about these women?
Everybody knew about them. Actually, one of the ironies is that as a couple, they were probably more loyal and monogamous than half of the heterosexual couples in Woodstock. I mean, Woodstock was notorious for, you know, bed hopping. I told somebody along the way a couple months ago I could have, the sideline of my research was enough that I could have written a book called Woodstock Babylon. And there's a tape, or a video recording of some of the old artists years ago talking about the Maverick festivals, and one of the jokes they tell is that, what is a husband? A husband is somebody you find in the bushes at the festival. So Wilna and Nan were unique. You know, they were very middle class, I guess, in that way, and very unique in their loyalty to each other.
What's next?
What's next?
Yeah, for you.
Well, I've actually begun exploring the possibility of doing a book on Nan Mason's father, Dan Mason, who was a vaudeville star and a movie star, because he's sort of one of the sideline characters in Living Large. And there were times when I felt bad that I couldn't include more about him. I tried to keep the story arc focused on those two women and how they developed together. And so the wonderful information I found out about Dan, there was just no place for it.
What kind of stays with you? Is there something in you did in the research or when you were in Woodstock? Is there something that's kind of inhabited your life from doing this project, this book, writing this book?
Oh, I think these two women have inhabited my life. I mean, I got to the point where at times I had to remind myself that I really didn't know them. There were moments when I was writing about them that I thought, you know, I'm writing about somebody I knew, and then I have to stop and say, well, no, I didn't actually know them. But they came across so strongly in their letters and through the photographs that they sort of became a living presence, and they're sort of haunting me, I guess.
And you have, you know, tape from one of these so-called wild parties, right, that they frequently host. But I think in the same breath, it's important to point out that they would host these, some of these, from what I understand, as fundraisers.
Yes, they almost always raised money at these parties. They were very sneaky about it. They waited till people got really drunk, and then they devised some way to, you know, empty their pockets. they had a lot of charities that they really strongly believed in them, most of them having to do with children, children's health centers and things like that. And one of their tricks, which I loved, they would tack up a big empty canvas on the side of a building. These parties were held outdoors, of course. And late in the evening, when everybody was really well lubricated, they would invite the artist to come forward and pay a fee to paint. And everybody, of course, wanted to outdo the others, and they were all drunk, and they all lined up, and they all paid to paint on this canvas. And then they would auction it off. And in the process, they made a great deal of money. By today's standards, you know, they would make a couple of $100, for instance, which by today's reckoning would be several thousand. It all went to charity.
So the big girls were shrewd girls, too.
They were very shrewd and very, very smart and very resourceful. I think it's important to point out that while they're raising this money, they were usually not paying their own bills because they didn't have any money of their own.
Any other anecdotes like that you can share with us or would like to share, please?
Well, there's another side to them, was Wilna in particular. I mean, they were always known, these two, as being, you know, very free spirits and very happy-go-lucky. But after the Second World War, Wilna was the person who led the charge to have a war memorial established in the center of Woodstock. You know, she was very, very touched by what had happened in the war, and several local young men had not come back to Woodstock. Her own nephew was shot down during the war, although he survived. And so, of all people, you know, this totally scatterbrained woman leads the local officials in getting a committee set up, and they planned and built a war memorial. And it's still there, right in the center of the town square, the village green, I guess they call it, in Woodstock. Now, it's not a war memorial anymore because some years ago they moved the actual plaques with the names to a local cemetery. All the hippies were sitting on it, and people thought that was disrespectful.
Mm.
But the flagpole and the monument itself is still there. So there was a serious side to Wilna. At one point, she's a civic activist.
Was there something, was there a twist and turn in their life that really took you by great surprise?
Actually, past a certain point, nothing I found out surprised me about them. I mean, I came to expect anything. But one thing that did kind of surprise me was when I visited their little cottage, where they lived most of their life. It was surprisingly small, and it wasn't insulated, of course. I eventually turned up photographs of how it was built. And the heat came from a fireplace, and began to realize that they, during the horrible winters when they did have to spend winters at Woodstock, they were cold. You know, they were wearing their coats around the house. The other thing about the size of the place that surprised me was not only were they big women themselves, but they always had a menagerie. And at one point they had something like 3 dogs and 4 cats and a parrot and a tank of goldfish. And all these little finches flying loose around the house making nests, and all in what amounts to just one big room with a bedroom off on one side. So that house must have been quite something, especially during the winter when everybody was cooped up indoors.
Oh, goodness. But it made it a little warmer, that art of communal living. But that is a tight space for not only their size, but for all those cohabitants, that's for sure. What do you think their legacy is?
Well, their legacy is a physical legacy in one regard. They left behind a lot of art. And, of course, some of Wilna's movies survive. And they get shown on a regular basis at a film festival that I do, and audiences still howl and scream like they always did. So that's a good part of their legacy. I think another part of their legacy is that they just set a wonderful example for, you know, living your life. I use the word, you know, the term living large, obviously, as a pun. They were living large in every sense of the word, but I mean, they were people who just enjoyed themselves. I think that's how they managed to live so long, considering how much they smoked and drank and ate all the wrong things. For women of the 19th century to make it into their mid-80s was quite an accomplishment, and I think it was their attitude and spirit that was a good part of that.
That was Joseph Eckhart, author of *Living Large*, Wilna Hervey and Nan Mason. He is Professor Emeritus of History at Montgomery County Community College in Bluebell, Pennsylvania. And here's an update to a story we brought you a few shows ago in which I'd interviewed 2 Seattle moms about their company, Budding STEM, which launched a line of girls' clothes that celebrates science, technology, engineering, and math, and other things typically marketed to boys. Jennifer Mum and Mallory Catchpole are the 2 Seattle moms behind Budding STEM, making clothes like rocket ship leggings and dinosaur dresses to empower young girls.
It's just more the message that's sent to little girls when all they see in the section that is labeled girls are kittens or rainbows or princesses.
Well, now Budding STEM is part of a group of 10 small independent businesses, all mom-owned, that have launched a campaign around back-to-school time called Clothes Without Limits, to raise awareness of the limited messages found in most girls' clothing departments and to bring attention to how those messages affect young girls' views of what it means to be a girl. The interview with the Budding STEM founders was in show number 1360. Let the rhythm change your world on the floor. You know we're at it tonight on the floor. Brazil, Morocco, London to Ibiza, straight to LA, New York, Vegas to Africa. We now turn to a story in Africa where something completely different is budding. For decades, men have dominated gyms in northern Ghana, mainly because most men would not allow their wives or daughters to enter a gym. Prejudices are widespread. Women often believe that they cannot have children once they exercise. In fact, you'll hear from one woman about dispelling the myth about exercise and giving birth. Meanwhile, some men are afraid their wives could become stronger than they are. But one young woman has defied all odds and has managed to become an aerobics teacher, as we hear in this report from DW correspondent Maxwell Sook, presented by Sarah Nicole.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Odette Alangea is putting a group through their paces outside the gym center in Tamale. They are all men, or nearly all of them. Claudette is the only female aerobics coach at the center, and she said it was a long journey to get this far.
Oh, I started as a student here. Then I was able to learn through the other senior instructors. Oh, it hasn't been easy. It takes a lot of endurance and then courage to do that.
She says it has never been easy coaching people of the opposite sex.
Being a female, standing in front of men, sometimes they don't respect you. You command them to do this and they will not do. So in our setting too, that is how they are. The men in the north, they want to control everything.
There are other old-fashioned reasons that discourage women in this part of the country from exercising, according to Sherif Fatou, another fitness freak who visits the center regularly.
Most of them, they feel shy to come out. And some of them, those who have not yet even gotten a child, they will tell you that they said when you are doing exercises, you are gymming, you can't give birth. So I've been telling them it is not true. Because I started doing sports as far back as 1971, active one to the national team. But I've got children and I'm still doing it. At the age of 62, I'm still doing it. Nothing is preventing you from giving birth when you are doing sports.
Inside the gym hall, it is loud and sweat drips down from almost everyone, but there are very few women. Two of the men say that they won't allow their wives to come to the gym.
The woman looks different when she's in a sporting outfit compared to being in her traditional clothes. Depending on the sort of mindset the man may have, he may decide not to.
When a woman does heavy exercises, she can become stronger than her husband. And if there's a little disagreement, because she's stronger than you, she will want to fight against you.
The National Sports Authority set up this gym center in Tamale 5 years ago for residents to keep fit. Patrick works as an administrative staff here, and he is worried that women do not really come forward.
Our target was the middle-level income earners, but we realized that fitness is something that everybody needs. We have opened our doors to everybody, students, artisans, everybody.
Abdallah Yahaya is a medical doctor in Tamale. He says that regular exercise prolongs an individual's lifespan.
Every cell in the body has a certain number of days or years it must live. And when you exercise, you may be able to extend it or at least make sure it reaches that date. If not, then those cells die earlier as a result of what we call hypoxia, too little oxygen. When that happens, it triggers the beginning of cancerogenous processes. That is what we call cancer.
Awudu Abukari is the welfare officer at the center. He says it has impacted the lives of many people in the north.
We have people who are obese. They come here and somehow it's able to go down. People who are hypertensive, people who are generally weak, who have not been exercising their bodies. And there are a lot of people who have given testimony.
However, many women are worried that exercising will have an anti-beauty effect. Ama Fringpong is one of them.
I don't want to have a hard skin. You know, women are supposed to maintain a soft skin to make a difference between women and men. That's what I know.
So it seems there are plenty of prejudices to be gotten rid of on both sides before people really appreciate the benefits of regular exercise.
8, 9, 10, over.
Again, that was Sarah Nicole presenting a report by DW correspondent Maxwell Suk. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1363.